Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, July 9th. I'm Lauren Schmidt.
And I'm Lisa Music, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, CAL FIRE crews grapple with Mina Fire amid heat wave.
Driver in fatal collision arrested for DUI after admitting to whippet use.
And tax relief and log jams for cultivators.
Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. The Shelley Fire, located in Siskiyou County, Klamath National Forest, is bringing moderate smoke impacts to the North Coast, including along the 101 corridor from Fortuna to Ukiah, as well as in Willow Creek and Hoopa along Highway 96 and in river drainages due to nighttime and morning inversions. Conditions are expected to remain moderate in these areas for the next several days. However, good air quality conditions are expected along the coast. You can check the air quality in your region online at fire.airnow.gov. In southeastern Humboldt and northern Mendocino, near their border with Trinity County, the Mina Fire is also causing significant smoke impacts, and evacuation warnings remain in place outside of Covelo. For more information, we spoke with CAL FIRE's Mendocino Unit, the lead on the Mina Fire.
I'm Ryan Smith, Deputy Chief of Fire Protection Operations for CAL FIRE Mendocino Unit. And just an update, overview of the Mina Fire, which is located north of Covelo, approximately about a one hour and 20 minute drive, Covelo Valley, south of the Trinity County line. Fire occurred yesterday, approximately 2 o'clock p.m., and was originally a report of a house on fire with 1 acre of vegetation. We were able to get a significant amount of aircraft on the fire due to extended response time for ground resources. In all, we ended up with 8 air tankers and 3 helicopters yesterday, and then I think we were sitting at about 28 fire engines total between yesterday and today's shift. It's currently holding at 53 acres, 35% containment. We do have control lines around the fire. The cause is still under investigation, and just continuing to mop up and improve control lines around the fire. Most of it is in heavy timber, so it's going to be putting up a lot of smoke and a significant amount of mop-up effort for probably several more days. Approximately 250 personnel currently supporting the incident.
Although the fire quickly grew to 50 acres in size, firefighters have been able to hold it at 53 acres over the last 24 hours. They expect to increase containment with their contingency lines already established around the fire's perimeter. An evacuation warning remains in place for Mendocino Zone MEN-1 COV-01. While the fire was initially reported as a structure fire that spread into vegetation, the deputy chief stated that that is unconfirmed at this time, and the cause remains under investigation.
For this early in the fire season, we're seeing really significant fire starts and spread. More than we've seen in the past couple of years. And we just really urge people to be extra fire safe. This is not a good indicator for what the later months, the summer, may have in store. The way this fire burned, if we had not been able to get the resources we had on it, could have been much more devastating. So, coming into the hotter peak of the summer, late July, August, into September, really need people to be cognizant, reduce the number of ignitions, because ultimately once we get these fires, we're going to start seeing the ability to flex resources and hold them small is going to diminish, and it's going to become very challenging.
Helpful tips on how to prepare your home and family can be found at readyforwildfire.org or you can download the Ready for Wildfire app onto your device.
Yeah, checkpoint of the plane incident. Subject is attempting to land just south of Salmon Creek exit. At 93, L55, current altitude's 3,700, correction, 3,700.
That was scanner traffic from yesterday, July 8th, around 4:20 p.m., as emergency personnel responded to the report of a plane in distress and needing to make an emergency landing on Highway 101. Emergency transmissions indicated that a private aircraft would be attempting to land on Highway 101 just south of the Salmon Creek exit. Garberville CHP received a request to shut down the highway in response to a mayday call from the pilot. As the plane neared, the pilot communicated his intention to try and glide to the Garberville airport instead. Emergency personnel were quickly redirected to prepare for a possible emergency landing at the airport.
He's attempting to make it to the Garberville airport. States he's within gliding range now.
By 4:30 p.m., scanner traffic confirmed that the plane had landed safely at the Garberville airport. Further details emerged during a phone interview with Sergeant Taylor of the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office. The pilot, the sole occupant of a Cessna aircraft, had contacted the Sheriff's Office, reporting engine issues and expressing uncertainty about reaching the airport. He mentioned that a landing on the freeway might be necessary. In response, HCSO personnel coordinated with allied agencies to prepare for an emergency landing on Highway 101 and dispatched deputies to the potential landing site. Shortly after, the pilot updated emergency services stating he could reach the airport on Sprawley Creek Road, just west of Garberville.
I want to call the ECC and have somebody call the Highway Patrol to go to the Garberville airport. There was an airplane, engine out, trying to make it to the airport at Garberville and just see if they can find anybody there.
The plane successfully landed without incident and deputies met the pilot at the airport, who confirmed he did not require further assistance.
The Eureka Police Department announced that they have a suspect in custody related to a fatal pedestrian collision that occurred in May. The driver, who turned herself in, admitted to using nitrous oxide, or whippets, just prior to the incident. Laura Montagna from the Eureka Police Department provided an overview of the original accident.
On Wednesday, May 22nd at approximately 1:45 p.m., Eureka Police Department and Humboldt Bay Fire responded to a vehicle versus pedestrian collision on the 900 block of I Street. While responding, additional reporting parties called advising multiple vehicles had also collided on I Street near 7th, and one of the involved vehicles collided into a building. Extrication was needed for the occupant of one of the vehicles. Upon arrival, EPD and Humboldt Bay Fire personnel took over life-saving efforts from bystanders. However, the 66-year-old male pedestrian succumbed to his injuries. Several occupants from the involved vehicles were transported to the hospital for injuries. A member of EPD's Major Injury Fatal Traffic Investigation Team responded to the scene to conduct the investigation. Additionally, EPD detectives and evidence technicians responded to assist with collecting witness statements and evidence. Based on preliminary findings, it appeared a vehicle was traveling north on I Street, collided with the pedestrian in the roadway near 9th Street, continued traveling north, collided with an additional vehicle near 7th Street, and then collided into a building.
The decedent was identified as 66-year-old David Sprague of Eureka. And as of yesterday, a suspect is now in custody.
On July 8th, we have an update that a Ramey warrant was issued for Maria Cuevas, 30 years old, from Eureka, for violations of vehicular manslaughter with gross negligence and hit and run causing death or injury. Additional charges of felony DUI causing bodily injury were submitted to the district attorney's office for review, as Cuevas admitted to using nitrous oxide just prior to the collision. Cuevas is currently in custody at the Humboldt County Correctional Facility on the above charges and is being held on a $65,000 bond and a probation hold.
The suspect, Cuevas, voluntarily surrendered herself to authorities. This is an active investigation, and the Eureka Police Department is asking anyone who witnessed the collision to contact their Criminal Investigations Unit at 707-441-4300.
So Eureka Police Department just wants everyone to know that it is a terrible thing for something like this to happen, using substances of any kind that alter your reaction time, your frame of mind, are extremely dangerous. Tragedies like this can be avoided. One person's life is lost and another is ruined, and it's needless. So people, please do not use substances and drive.
KMA News extends our condolences to the family of the decedent. Humboldt County offers substance use disorder services as part of a wellness and recovery program. You can contact their 24-hour substance use disorder access line at 1-855-765-9703.
Turning to Mendocino, authorities have identified the woman whose body was discovered in the waters off of the Mendocino County coast in April of this year. Through DNA analysis, the woman has been identified as Angela Giovanna Carrillo Palomar, 29-year-old resident of Fort Bragg. On April 26, earlier this year, at approximately 2:54 p.m., the Mendocino County Sheriff's Office received a report of a possible human body floating in the ocean just south of Fort Bragg. Deputies responded swiftly, confirming the presence of a deceased individual. The recovery operation was in joint effort with coordination from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, the California Department of State Parks, and the Mendocino Volunteer Fire Department. Due to challenging ocean conditions and the steep, rocky shoreline, the decision was made to recover the body by boat and transport it to Noyo Harbor. Once at Noyo Harbor, deputies initiated a coroner's investigation. Initially, they could not identify the body due to a lack of distinguishing marks, but they suspected the decedent to be an adult female based on the clothing found. The investigation took a significant turn on May 1st when a coroner's investigative technician attended the autopsy and obtained a DNA sample. The sample was crucial as it matched the physical characteristics of a missing person reported to the Fort Bragg Police Department on April 14th. With this lead, the Sheriff's Office collected familial DNA samples from the missing person's family. These samples were sent to the Department of Justice DNA Lab in Richmond, California. On July 3, 2024, the Mendocino County Sheriff's Office Coroner's Division received confirmation that the DNA sample matched Angela Giovanna Carrillo Palomar. The identification of Angela brings some closure, yet the investigation continues. The Mendocino County Sheriff's Office is urging anyone with information related to this case to come forward. You can contact their dispatch center at 707-463-4086 or provide anonymous tips through their non-emergency tip line at 707-234-2100. Information specifically related to the missing persons investigation can also be provided directly to the Fort Bragg Police Department by calling their dispatch center at 707-964-0200. This case highlights the importance of DNA analysis in solving missing persons cases and bringing closure to families. We extend our deepest condolences to Angela Giovanna Carrillo Palomar's family and friends during this difficult time.
Despite a proposed reduction in cannabis tax for the next 2 years, complex regulatory challenges continue to hinder growers in achieving full licensure, leaving many at risk of falling short of legal cultivation requirements. KZYX's Sarah Wraith reports.
Though a reduction in the cannabis tax is on the table for the next 2 years, there are still log jams for those who remain in the cannabis industry. Only 23 growers in the county have achieved the goal of obtaining the coveted combination of county license plus annual state license. Another 481 have provisional licenses. They have until the end of the year to upgrade to the state annual. Sarah McBurney, the senior cannabis program manager with the county's cannabis department, told the Board of Supervisors General Government Committee this week that growers who are required to complete a biological survey to get that license appear to be out of luck.
If it is found that they need a bio survey and it has to occur during a certain window, i.e. they're needed to have a spring flora review, for example, that window has already passed. So if we're reviewing your application in July, we see you need a bio survey and it has to happen in the spring, you cannot complete that bio survey until next spring, which puts us past that 12/31 deadline. Currently, we've exhausted options at the local level to try to see if we could issue these either with conditions or what we could do with the M&D to try to get them issued by that statute date, but we were unsuccessful.
Local cultivator and longtime cannabis advocate Corinne Powell asked McBurney what's in store for people who missed the deadline. The county permit is called a CCBL, or Cannabis Cultivation Business License. The state is conducting an environmental impact review, or EIR, to license commercial cannabis cultivation in the county.
If we know that we have X applicants in the queue, and we know that they cannot legally cultivate if they are not holding a provisional license at this time, and the state stops issuing them and they have not been approved for a provisional license at the state level, what happens with our processing at the county level?
So anyone that applies for a new CCBL application or a phase three application would have to apply for an annual licensure at the state level. So once you apply at the county, there is no timeline that is needed for you to apply at the state. You don't have to be issued at the county level in order to start the application at the state process. And I would encourage applicants to start that annual application sooner rather than later. But it is true that you cannot cultivate without that annual license at the DCC level. At this time, the draft EIR just closed comment period, so there is not a clear pathway for annual licensure. However, through the finishing of the EIR, it is our belief that there will be a more clear pathway for that annual licensure to obtain CEQA and then to cultivate in the county. But yes, you will be a county-level CCBL. You could be under review, you could be issued, you could have a county CCBL permit in hand, you could be paying taxes, you can be paying your annual renewal fees or potentially multiple renewal fees, but not be able to legally cultivate commercial cannabis.
McBurney added that another logjam is that another 55 of the pending applications for the month of May are stuck waiting on a review and referral process by CDFW. Supervisor John Haschak asked Deputy County Counsel Jared Schwass to explain a density procedure, which allows growers to apply for permits to grow up to 22,000 square feet, more than double the 10,000 that was widely understood to be the maximum when 10A17, the cultivation ordinance, was adopted in 2017. Schwass said the ordinance clearly states that two licenses are allowable due to contemplations by the Mitigated Negative Declaration, or MND, the environmental document that was prepared for the ordinance.
The MND contemplates that individuals will have up to 22,000 square feet of cultivation on their parcel if they have a nursery. There is no distinction between of environmental impacts between a nursery and mature cannabis canopy. And so the environmental impacts are similar and or the same. So the MND does contemplate this. There is no expansion, as people like to say it. This is not an expansion of the MND. The MND contemplated 22,000 square feet of total canopy space for each parcel that is able to cultivate in the zoning code and in the ordinance.
Supervisor Glenn McGordy is thinking about how best to render cannabis data for the next crop report. The most recent crop report is from 2021, but Angela Godwin, the new Ag Commissioner, arrived this week and is pledged to throw herself into bringing the reports up to date.
The area that's under cultivation by permit to be 131 acres. Put it in perspective for irrigated agriculture in our county, so we have approximately between 20 and 25,000 irrigated acres, so this is less than 0.5% of the area. I want something in the crop report that reflects the amount of cultivation, even if it's just the fees that are paid to the county. I think that's important. It's very difficult probably to get a crop value, but at least if we have some information about the cannabis industry, I would like that to be public.
McGordy and Haschak agreed to ask the full board to provide some tax relief to those who remain in the legal cannabis industry. Haschak noted that the current two-year-old 50% reduction in cannabis business tax is set to expire this year. He suggested lowering the reduction to 40% next year and 35% the following year. Deputy CEO Tony Rake said the executive office is projecting about $1 million in cannabis tax for the next fiscal year, assuming the 50% reduction, though the projection for the current fiscal year is already exceeding the original. McBurney said the projected net county cost to the cannabis department for next fiscal year is $550,000. The full board will have the final say on the tax proposal. For KZYX News, I'm Sarah Reif.
In state news, top California Democrats announced this week that they will ask voters to approve a plan cracking down on retail theft in the state, in a plan intended to compete with another crime-focused ballot measure seeking to reform Prop 47. KPFA's Scott Baba reports.
Governor Gavin Newsom and Democratic lawmakers negotiated their own ballot plan over the weekend after failing to convince a tough-on-crime coalition to withdraw its efforts to reform Proposition 47 from the ballot. The progressive ballot measure, approved by 60% of state voters in 2014, which reduced certain theft and drug possession offenses from felonies to misdemeanors to help address overcrowding in jails, and which expanded the state's investment in drug and mental health treatment. In recent years, Proposition 47 has become the focus of critics who say California is too lax on crime. Both proposals would make shoplifting a felony for repeat offenders and increase penalties for fentanyl dealers. Under the ballot measure proposed by a group of county district attorneys and backed by a coalition of business groups, any prior theft-related convictions, even if they happened years ago, would count towards a three-strike policy for increased sentences. It would also create a new class of offenses called treatment-mandated felony to charge those in possession of hard drugs like cocaine, meth, and fentanyl. Meanwhile, the ballot measure unveiled by Democratic lawmakers this week also proposes harsher punishment for repeat thieves, but the convictions would have to happen within 3 years of each other. At the same time, under the Democrats' plan, prosecutors could aggregate the amount of all stolen goods within 3 years to charge harsher offenses, and it would increase penalties for dealers who mix drugs with fentanyl without the purchaser's knowledge. Republican lawmakers blasted the Democrats' plan, calling it a, quote, sham to confuse voters. But Democratic lawmakers said the district attorney's proposal is too broad. They worry its changes would disproportionately incarcerate low-income people and those with substance use issues, rather than targeting ringleaders who hire large groups of people to steal goods for resale online. San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan joined San Francisco Mayor London Breed in supporting the district attorney ballot measure in February. He said that while the new ballot measure put forward by Democratic lawmakers is a step in the right direction, he still supports the older proposal because it mandates mental health and addiction treatment for those who commit certain felonies.
We have people dying, literally dying on our streets for lack of supportive services, for lack of treatment, sometimes for refusing to engage in treatment. And it is neither compassionate nor progressive to leave people to die on our streets. I think government's fundamental responsibility is keeping people safe. And this proposal, in my view, still falls short on that measure.
The legislature will vote this week on whether the measure will appear on the ballot. If both propositions win over a majority of voters, the one with the highest number of yes votes will become law. I'm Scott Baba, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
Some Arab American, Jewish, and civil rights group blasted proposed state legislation. They said would chill campus free speech and lead to increased targeting of Palestinian students and faculty members. They opposed a measure aimed at protecting students in California colleges and universities from harassment and violence, and another that would put Holocaust and genocide education in the hands of a group critics said ignored Palestinian perspectives. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The newly formed California-Palestine Solidarity Coalition is blasting what it calls misleading measures in the state legislature. The coalition of civil rights groups, students, unions, and other activists held a news conference outside the state capitol in Sacramento. Omar Altamimi is with the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE for short.
As we've seen protests erupt over the past 7 months on college campuses, we've seen a almost militarized approach from colleges and campuses towards these students to silence them.
One of the bills the activists are concerned about is Senate Bill 1287 by Democratic Senator Stephen Glaser of Contra Costa. It's aimed at protecting college and university students from harassment, violence, and discrimination. The Assembly Judiciary Committee's analysis of the measure says the bill is phrased in neutral language, but clearly responds to a specific development, namely campus protests against Israel's actions in Gaza.
The actions of universities in this bill in particular encroach on constitutionally protected rights of our students, and it's a clear infringement on sacred First Amendment rights. Universities have always been the leading platform of dissent, free speech, and impactful protests. Ethnic studies, the ethnic studies curriculum was born out of encampments at San Francisco State and UC Berkeley. We have the civil rights and labor movements that were a cornerstone almost, or used universities as cornerstones to get out their message.
Jonah Gottlieb also opposes SB 1287. He graduated from UC Berkeley last month.
Where I found the most safety and community as a Jewish student at UC Berkeley was at our Free Palestine encampment on the Mario Savio steps at Sproul Plaza.
Gottlieb says Glaser's bill would chill campus free speech and even incite more anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. He says the student encampment at Berkeley showed a better way.
The community that we built in the encampment was one of solidarity, of learning, and open-mindedness, where we openly disagreed and talked about what a future liberated Palestine can and will look like. And we did that not by suppressing free speech and disagreement, but by welcoming it. We worked together, we collaborated, we built a beautiful community at UC Berkeley that is a microcosm of what I believe can and will be the future, both in the East Bay, where the Ark encampment was, but also in a free Palestine.
Irish Rosenblum Sellers is a graduate student worker at UC Berkeley and a member of United Auto Workers Local 4811. She says the right to free speech on college campuses was won decades ago by students protesting the Vietnam War.
That successful fight led to successful protest movements against South African apartheid and later protests against the Gulf War and wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and now the genocidal war in Gaza. Though members of the legislature may support the current war, they cannot take the steps of passing SB 1287 and SB 1277, criminalizing campus protests and indoctrinating students into supporting the war.
That second bill Rosenblum mentioned, SB 1277, is a measure by Democratic Senator Henry Stern of Los Angeles. The bill sets up a body called the California Teachers Collaborative for Holocaust and Genocide Education to be in charge of developing materials and teacher training on Holocaust and genocide in public schools. Critics say that collaborative has strong ties to pro-Israel groups, and they say the bill would freeze Palestinian perspectives out of the curriculum. Cassandra Kachakji is with the nonprofit Arab Resource and Organizing Center.
These bills undo the good work of teachers who have been working alongside one another to educate about relationships between anti-Semitism, anti-blackness, anti-racism, and Islamophobia. We stand united in rejecting these disingenuous attempts to gut our children's education and target Palestinian solidarity.
SB 1277 is awaiting action in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. Senator Glaser's 1287 is scheduled for a hearing in the Judiciary Committee on Tuesday, July 2nd. Meanwhile, Al-Tamimi of CARE says the groups will continue to working to either block the two bills or, at least, to reduce the harm through amendments.
We all hope to change the world for the better by ensuring that our students continue to have this right to speak freely.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips.
And thanks to our reporters, Sarah Reith, Scott Baba, and Christopher Martinez.
KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, and videos.
If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.
And I'm Lauren Schmidt.